From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A strong response from the State Department denying any U.S. involvement in the assassination of Russia's ambassador to Turkey early this week. This was State Department spokesperson John Kirby at Tuesday's daily press briefing at the Department of State.
With respect to American involvement slash support, tacit or otherwise, for this unspeakable assassination yesterday because of the presence of Mr. Gulen here in the United States. And it is a ludicrous claim, absolutely false. There's no basis of truth in it whatsoever. And the secretary made that very clear in his discussions today with the foreign minister.
Kirby's statement was made in reply to reports attributed to Turkey's foreign ministry that its foreign minister, Mevlüt Cavusoglu, told U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry that Ankara and Moscow suspected that followers of Fethullah Gulen, a Turkish exile living in the U.S., were behind the assassination of Russia's ambassador Andrei Karlov in an attempt to undermine Ankara's increasingly close ties with Moscow and derail a peace process in Syria being led by Russia, Turkey, and Iran. Kirby denied any knowledge of Gulen's involvement.
Well, what about the aspect of Gulen's followers being involved?
I think there's an active investigation going on, Steve, and I'm not going to get ahead of that. I don't know, and I don't think you know, what the motivations were behind this individual. I mean, I saw, just like you saw, what he was shouting and screaming after he shot the ambassador. But we need to let the investigators do their job. That we need to let them, let the facts and the evidence take them where it is before we jump to conclusions. But any notion that the United States was in any way supportive of this or behind this or even indirectly involved is absolutely ridiculous.
Earlier Tuesday, the foreign and defense ministers of Russia, Turkey, and Iran met in Moscow to discuss the political process to end the conflict in Syria, stressing the importance of respecting the country's sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity. Following the talks Tuesday, Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov opened a joint press conference held with the foreign ministers of Iran and Turkey.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've just finished a meeting of the foreign ministers of Russia, Iran, and Turkey. In parallel, there were meetings in Moscow between the defense ministers of our countries in various formats. They were focused on the situation in Syria, and we share an opinion primarily that it is necessary to fully respect the sovereignty, territorial integrity, and unity of Syria. It is also our shared opinion that there is no military solution to the Syrian crisis. We advocate the notion that there is no alternative to a political settlement in this conflict. Of course, task number one is ending the sufferings of civilians, addressing humanitarian issues, and fighting terrorism non-compromisingly. We have agreed on a joint statement by the foreign ministers of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Russian Federation, and the Turkish Republic on coordinated measures aimed at encouraging a political process aimed at ending the Syrian conflict. This is a statement by three foreign ministers, but I would like to emphasize that a contribution to reaching an agreement was also made by the defense ministers of our three countries who met at the same time as us. The joint statement confirms respect for the territorial integrity, sovereignty, and unity of Syria as a multi-ethnic, multi-community, secular, and democratic country. Russia, Iran, and Turkey are confident that there is no military solution to the Syrian crisis. They recognize the important role of the United Nations in resolving this crisis in compliance with the UN Security Council Resolution 2254. They also take into account decisions by the International Support for Syria Group. They call upon the international community to cooperate in order to remove the obstacles to implementing the agreements arising from the aforementioned resolution. They welcome the efforts in eastern Aleppo that have enabled a free evacuation of civilians and organized the evacuation of rebels. We also welcome the partial evacuation of opposition of the opposition from a number of Syrian locations in Syria and advocate a successful and safe completion of this process. The three countries would like to express their gratitude to the International Red Cross Committee and the WHO for their assistance in carrying out this evacuation. We would like to advocate enlarging the ceasefire, providing access to humanitarian aid and free movement for civilians across the territory of Syria. Iran, Russia, and Turkey would like to express their willingness to assist in reaching an agreement which is now being prepared and negotiated by the Syrian government and the opposition. And our three countries are prepared to act as safeguards and warranters of such an agreement, and we call upon all the countries of goodwill to follow suit. We are convinced that such an agreement would help give an impetus to a renewed political process in Syria in accordance with the UN Security Council Resolution 2254. We mean an agreement that the Syrian government and the opposition have been jointly working on. The three foreign ministers take note of the kind invitation from the President of Kazakhstan to host a meeting to that end in Astana in Kazakhstan. In conclusion, Russia, Iran and Turkey confirm their willingness to jointly fight ISIS and al-Nusra and separate from them armed opposition groups in Syria. We are satisfied with the result that we are seeing. We are confident that in a situation when UN Security Council resolutions have been stalling and their implementation have been stalling, an initiative by our three countries would help overcome the stagnation in addressing the Syrian crisis based on the UN Security Council resolution and promote the developments and the processes in ending the hostilities and delivering humanitarian aid and providing an environment for an efficient and inclusive political process in Syria. I would like to thank my fellow foreign ministers. This has been some fruitful, efficient work. We have agreed to continue building on today's joint statement, continuing and developing our cooperation. Thank you.
Lavrov's statement was followed by a statement from Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif.
I would also like to thank my old friend and colleague, Mr. Lavrov, for the welcoming that I received, and I would like to condemn the terrorist act led to the death of the Russian ambassador in Turkey, and we express our condolences to his family and his colleagues, and also, of course, to the colleagues, his colleagues in the Russian Foreign Ministry. We are convinced that the situation in Syria needs international cooperation to fight against terrorism, and we need to stop violence and bloodshed and deliver humanitarian aid to the whole of the Syrian people, including the cooperation of all the parties involved who have their influence in the region, who can affect the region. In the recent days, this cooperation between three countries, Russia, Iran, and Turkey, in terms of the extraction of non-militant people from several regions of Syria and the extraction of people from Aleppo. The process was underway, and we hope that, thanks to the joint statement that Mr. Lavrov has noted, there is. It also says that Iran and Turkey will help to stop the conflict in Syria, and there are logical consecutive steps to move forward. We hope that there will be humanitarian aid provided to the people, and that a political solution will be found in keeping with the principles stated in the joint statements for, I mean, the respect for sovereignty and territorial integrity of the country. So we hope for a political solution of the conflict, and we believe that with our joint efforts we will be able, as soon as possible, to end the suffering of the Syrian people from terrorism, and we will provide help for the future of Syria and the region. Thank you very much.
The statement by Iran's foreign minister was followed by a statement from Turkey's foreign minister, Mevlüt Cavusoglu.
Dear representatives of the press, today we met under the chairmanship of my dear friend, Minister Sergey Lavrov, in order to discuss ending the civil war in Syria and ending the drama, the human drama in Aleppo. Together with our third colleague, the foreign minister of Iran. Today, we also had a bilateral meeting with Mr. Lavrov, and like I said, with regard to the death of the Russian ambassador in Turkey, Mr. Andrei Karlov, from myself personally and on behalf of the government of Turkey, we would like to express our condolences to the people of Russia, to the government of Russia, and to Minister Lavrov. We condemn this assault, this attack. This is the first time we meet in such a format, and this is an event, an important event in itself. We have discussed how to relieve the humanitarian crisis in Aleppo and provide unimpeded evacuation. We were discussing some of the practical issues in this regard. In general, over 37,500 people have been liberated in Aleppo, and Russia made an important contribution to that, ensuring the ceasefire in Syria and expanding it onto all of Syria's regions was also one of the issues on our agenda today. We were discussing how to ensure it, how to provide for it. We spoke of the necessity of a political solution, that there is no alternative to it, and that we must make sure that it is consistent and continuous, and that it must be based on the relevant documents adopted by the United Nations and its bodies in order to ensure a permanent ceasefire in Syria. Provide an enabling environment for the start of a political process and ensure access for humanitarian aid. These are all of the issues that we have discussed today. And once again, I would like to thank my colleagues and my fellow foreign ministers for today's meeting.
The political center of gravity around the war in Syria seems to have shifted away from the United States and towards Russia, particularly since the election of Donald Trump in November indicated a strong shift in U.S. policy towards Syria was on the horizon. CCTV's Jessica Stone has more.
Ever since his November election win, President-elect Donald Trump has been laying the groundwork for major changes in American foreign policy, in some cases sending signals that could turn foes into friends and friends into foes. On Russia, Trump has expressed a desire to work closer with the Kremlin than Barack Obama did during his two terms, after the U.S. intelligence community, including the CIA, declared that Russia tried to swing the election. Trump and his aides pushed back.
I think he would accept the conclusion if these intelligence professionals would get together, put out a report, show the American people that they're actually on the same page.
On Israel, Trump signaled a reversal of Obama's support for a Palestinian state. Trump's pick for U.S. Ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, supports the legalization of settlements and Israel annexing the West Bank. Friedman has also questioned the need for a Palestinian state and says he expects to work from a U.S. embassy in Jerusalem, a city still claimed by both Israelis and Palestinians as their rightful capital.
A Trump administration will never pressure Israel into a two-state solution or any other solution that is against the wishes of the Israeli people.
And earlier this month, Trump took a new position on U.S. policy towards China, talking with the leader of Taiwan by phone, breaking with decades of precedent, saying the U.S. is not bound by the One China policy, a mainstay of Sino-U.S. relations, and tweeting that China stole a U.S. naval drone, then telling Beijing to keep it. Concern is mounting in Beijing, particularly over Trump's stance on Taiwan.
Adhering to the One China principle is the political foundation for the development of China-U.S. relations.
China is not the only country paying close attention. Of course, Iran is watching closely to see if President-elect Donald Trump will upend the Iranian nuclear deal. And Cuba is also on guard to see if Trump reverses the historic normalization of diplomatic relations with the United States.
Cuba was a topic of discussion at the United Nations on Tuesday, where a commemorative session was held honoring the life and work of former President Fidel Castro. This was the President of the UN General Assembly, Peter Thompson of Fiji, at the UN Tuesday.
On the evening of 25th November 2016, Fidel Castro Ruz, the former President of Cuba, passed away in Havana at 90 years of age. Today, the membership of the United Nations comes together to pay tribute to one of the 20th century's most iconic and influential leaders. For nearly five decades, the late President Castro led the Cuban Revolution. And for many, he embodied the struggle of the global South for independence, justice, and development. As Prime Minister and then President of his country, Fidel Castro propelled Cuba onto the global stage by staunchly advocating against what he saw as the inequities of the prevailing world order. His activism in pursuit of a fairer and more just world made him a symbol of resistance and inspiration to people across the world, in Latin America, Africa, and beyond. A skilled orator, President Castro was capable of capturing the attention of crowds for hours on end with his rhetoric of sovereignty and aspiration. Perhaps best illustrated by his record-breaking speech delivered here in the UN General Assembly in 1960. For most Cubans, Fidel Castro was not just a global figure of revolution. He was and will always remain the man who brought them both dignity and the levels of progress in social development that remain the envy of many around the world. With free public education and health care guaranteed under the Cuban Constitution, Fidel Castro's greatest achievement was arguably to bring Cuba's illiteracy and infant mortality rates to amongst the lowest in the world. Even today, Cuba's public health care system has been recognized by the World Health Organization as a model for others, proving that even with scarce resources, it is possible to provide care for the most vulnerable. Bearing in mind the major restrictions on the development of the Cuban economy and the lives of its people, Cuba's accomplishments throughout this period become even more impressive. They demonstrate the unbreakable Cuban spirit that Fidel Castro himself came to symbolize perhaps better than any other. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, with the modifications to the Cuban embargo and the implementation of domestic reforms, Cuba is currently experiencing a period of renewal and readjustment, and I know that I speak for all member states when I wish the Cuban government and its people the very best in this endeavor. In doing so, I'd like to turn the focus back onto us, the members of the United Nations. An internationalist to the core, in his last intervention at the United Nations on the occasion of the Millennium Summit, President Castro laid out the challenges that humanity would seek to address 15 years later with the Sustainable Development Goals. And he stated, "Anyone can comprehend that the fundamental objective of the United Nations in this century, which is upon us, is that of saving the world not only from warfare, but from underdevelopment, hunger, disease, poverty, and the destruction of natural resources indispensable for human existence." As we honor the life and mourn the passing of this uniquely influential figure, we take solace in the fact that his core ideals, solidarity, development, peace, justice, and mutual respect, will continue to endure. Our hearts and thoughts are with the family of Mr. Castro, as well as the Cuban government and people. May he rest in peace.
Among the many speakers honoring the late Fidel Castro at the UN session on Tuesday was Venezuela's permanent representative, Samuel Moncada, who spoke on behalf of the non-aligned movement.
Mr. President, it is an honor for me to join with you all to pay tribute to the life and legacy of former President Fidel Castro Ruz, leader of the Cuban Revolution, who passed away on the 25th of November 2016. Allow me first to convey our respects, solidarity, and sincere sentiments of sympathy and condolences to the people and government of the Republic of Cuba, as well as to the family of the Cuban leader, particularly to his brother, President Raul Castro Ruz, at this difficult time. Mr. President, President Fidel Castro was a founding member of our non-aligned movement and the only representative of the Latin American and Caribbean region that participated in the Belgrade Conference of 1961. It is worth noting that he was a true advocate for the Global South and a new international economic order, as well as for the establishment of a peaceful, prosperous, just, equitable, and multipolar world in line with the Bandung principles which serve as the basis of our movement. His positions and his commitment made him the chair of the non-aligned movement on two occasions, between 1979 and 1983, and between 2004 and 2006, during which he at times also played an instrumental role in the defense of the developing world and in promoting our just causes. Our movement has therefore lost a leader of enormous character, great courage and vision, a man who was able to have an influence in and was able to forge new leaders in many countries of our movement and beyond. Mr. President, the imprint of President Fidel Castro is all around his beloved Cuba, where he fought through the implementation of progressive policies for social justice, for the promotion of the well-being of his fellow nationals. Under his leadership, his country made great achievements. Inter alia, the fulfillment of the Millennium Development Goals, particularly in the fields of education, literacy, and health. However, his mark also goes far beyond the borders of his homeland, as his high sense of solidarity toward other nations and peoples, even in times of natural disasters, this earned him deep recognition from the international community. He was also a champion of those marginalized and oppressed, as well as a prominent figure in the decolonization processes, particularly in Africa. And for this, he will always be remembered. Mr. President, President Fidel Castro was one of those leaders who made a difference in his country, the entire region, and the world as a whole. He will be remembered as an emblematic icon of the Cuban Revolution, a prominent figure in Latin America and the Caribbean, and as a leader one who was committed to the just causes of the world, with an incredible ability to connect with the most vulnerable and provide them with a voice so that their aspirations could be heard. It is for all these reasons that today the non-aligned movement grieves together with the family of former President Fidel Castro, with the people of Cuba, and with all those others around the world that share the same ideals and are committed to working tirelessly for the well-being of the peoples and the just causes around the world. Thank you very much, sir.
Following the certification of Donald Trump as the next president of the United States by the Electoral College this past Monday, forces are gathering to protest at the inauguration on January 20th. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford has some advice for protesters.
If the U.S. ruling class and the spies and national security goons that serve them wanted to divert attention from all the crimes and crises of capitalism, they have temporarily succeeded. In this insane post-election season, all the corporate media want to talk about is the outrageous fiction that Russia is the greatest threat to American domestic peace and tranquility. Jim Crow stole the election, as usual, but the corporate media and Hillary Clinton's minions blame it on the Russians. Tens of thousands of people will descend on Washington to denounce Donald Trump's inauguration, which, given his horrific appointments and domestic policies, would be the righteous thing to do. If Clinton had won, she too should have been confronted with vast crowds of demonstrators determined to bring her to heel for crimes of mass black incarceration and a whole list of other offenses against humanity. But it's already clear that the useless and self-serving black misleadership class, who work for the Democratic Party rather than for their black constituents, will be making common cause with the CIA and the war profiteers and shouting their worthless heads off about Vladimir Putin, who, to paraphrase Muhammad Ali, never called anybody the N-word that we know of, or kicked millions of poor women and children off welfare, or imposed a reign of terror in black communities. That was the Clintons, remember? The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations will also be in Washington around the time of the inauguration, on January 14th, the day before Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday. But the coalition will not join hands with Hillary's friends on Wall Street and the Pentagon. Instead, Black is Back will declare to the world its intention to fight for black self-determination in every aspect of life, despite the rise of Donald Trump and his version of white nationalism. The Black is Back Coalition is telling the incoming administration that black people are their own liberators. And that is a very different kind of message than you'll be hearing from the black servants of the Democratic Party, who have made a pact with that section of the U.S. ruling class that has rallied around Hillary Clinton, a raving, maniacal war criminal who is culpable in the death of millions. The black misleadership class can imagine no other way to function except to become junior partners with one powerful group of oppressors or the other. Independent black politics is alien to them because they see no money in it, no profit in the liberation of other black people. And so they methodically sacrifice black folks' interests and the hopes and dreams of all oppressed peoples in return for some squatting room at the feet of the enemy. The black misleaders have no shame and no demands either, except that they get paid. The Black is Back Coalition, on the other hand, has put forward a 19-point agenda to guide the fight for black self-determination, a human right of all peoples, and the basis of solidarity among the oppressed. Points that will be thoroughly discussed on January 14th at Freedom Plaza at 14th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. The struggle is not about choosing between Trump and Clinton. It's about black self-determination and bringing down this evil system. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.